On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we break down Cody Bellinger being dealt to the New York Yankees. He'll have to shave that 7 o'clock shadow, but what else do you need to know? We'll also jump into the MLB report about elbow injuries for pitchers and do the good, the bad, and the ugly, because it's always a good shtick, we think. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that Cody Bellinger is secretly also an astrophysicist. I'm Jake Mintz, and that's Jordan Schusterman, because his brain is in space.
Ah, I see. I was like, where are you going with this? But yes, Cody Bellinger, known for always looking rather confused, inquisitive. How would you describe the general state of Cody Bellinger's blank stare over the course of a major league game?
Aloof.
Aloof. We are going to talk about Cody Bellinger on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. You are not going to believe it, but Jake's still in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But it's great to see you. We are recording this on Wednesday evening, East Coast time, Thursday morning, Saigon time. And Jake, Cody Bellinger was traded to the Yankees, as we all expected. That will be our first topic. It's time for the opener.
Every great game begins with an opener. That's what the Tampa Bay Rays taught me. And the Tampa Bay Rays will not be employing Cody Bellinger next season, probably or ever, as Bellinger goes from the Chicago Cubs to the New York Yankees in exchange for Cody Poteet, a right-handed pitcher. Cody for Cody. Now, if you look at this trade and you're like, Cody Bellinger got traded for a guy I've never heard of named Cody Poteet, what's that about? We're here to answer those questions, and you should maybe watch some Cody Bellinger highlights since 2019.
I do think it is a relevant place to start, because we had a conversation on the last episode about the Cubs and how they have basically operated over the course of this winter as if Cody Bellinger was not on the team, was not going to be on the team. But it was not necessarily a simple thing to trade Cody Bellinger once he opted into the $27.5 million he is owed in 2025, and perhaps another $20-plus million in 2026, which I think is a relevant part of this conversation too, because what the Cubs had to find was a team who not only wanted to employ Cody Bellinger, but was willing to pay a good chunk of Cody Bellinger's salary for both this upcoming season and for the season potentially after that if he does not opt out after 2025. And what we learned is that that was a very short list of teams. And once those teams were identified, which from what we can tell, that was really down to two teams. Brian Cashman, speaking about it today, said that he knew that the Cubs were deciding to trade Bellinger between the Yankees or somewhere else. Based on the reporting, it seems like that somewhere else was Toronto. But either way, once you got it down to those two teams and the Cubs had put themselves in a situation where they were committed to trading him, why would the Yankees give up a top prospect? They ultimately did have the leverage here, and they said, we'll pay for it because we're the Yankees and we have money, and we wanted to spend $700 million on one player. Now we're going to use that money in other ways. This is a way they chose to use it, which is to take on this contract and thus only give up Cody Poteet.
What is Cody Bellinger now? To understand that, we must turn the clock back to the beginning of his career. He comes up in 2017 as a 21-year-old with the Los Angeles Dodgers and wins Rookie of the Year. He is sensational again in 2018, albeit with a little more swing and miss. And then in 2019, he just shows up and wins MVP. He bashes 47 homers. He has a 167 OPS plus. And at this point, we're looking at Cody Bellinger, a 23-year-old with 111 home runs. And we're saying irresponsible things like, should Barry Bonds be worried?
Yeah. And what like, what we did not realize was, one, that the baseball would, at least for now, never, ever be like what it was from 2017 to 2019. And then also that Cody Bellinger how his career would kind of unfold after that was not something that really any of us could have possibly seen coming. Now, some of that is due to some very unfortunate injuries, including injuring his shoulder, celebrating a home run during the 2020 postseason. But then even if you account for that, how bad it got in 2021, where he was one of the worst players in the league, is still one of the more stunning downfalls that we've seen in the last 20 years. I mean, for what those heights were in 2019, even if you did accept that was probably the best season he was ever going to have, he literally, his OPS was half what it was in 2019. It was a shocking fall from stardom. And then we kind of had to recalibrate all along.
2020 to 2022, he's 24% worse than league average offensively. And that leads to him being non-tendered by the Los Angeles Dodgers after 2022. He signs a one-year deal with the Chicago Cubs and is really good. He remakes himself. He ditches the big swinging power approach for a much more contact-oriented strategy at the plate, and it pays dividends. He's worth 4.5 wins. He is 39% better than league average, and we think we're seeing a Cody Bellinger rejuvenation. He's a new player. He's a different player, but he is still a good and valuable one. He re-ups with the Cubs for a 3-year deal, Scott Boras W. And last year is just a soggier, less inspiring version of his 2023 self. Is he good now? Is he a good player? Is he a great player? I think it is important to understand, like, in many people's heads, they are holding out hope that the 8.5 win 47 ding dong Cody Bellinger is beneath the surface somewhere. That's not going to happen, Yankees fans. Many, I'm sure, know this. That's not going to happen. That's not who this is anymore. Cody Bellinger is a valuable, worthwhile piece who can do a lot of things for your ball club, but he is not a dynamic offensive presence. He is not a Juan Soto replacement in the lineup.
No, not even close. And we talk often about sequencing in an offseason and when you get players and when you fill them in. And the fact that the Yankees have thus far decided to add impact pitching before they address their many holes in the lineup makes Bellinger as the first offensive addition in name value. You're like, oh, you're cooking. It just rolls off the tongue just like Max Fried and Devin Williams, right? He's even more famous than Devin Williams and even Max Fried, arguably, right? Like, because Bellinger has been in our life for a long enough time playing for these high-profile teams, and even when it got so bad, he was still Cody Bellinger, and you're like, oh, well, but come on, this guy's rookie of the year, this guy's MVP, he's still in his mid-20s. And what he did in 2023 was so incredible because it was just such a departure from the style of player that we had thought that he was. But because it was so different, you know, I know you said we don't have to boot up the Scobo again, but like, let's remember, after he had that rejuvenation, people thought he was going to get a lot more than the 3-year, $80 million deal that he ended up getting last year. He goes back to the Cubs, and to your point, that same approach stays the same, but the overall value does not. And, you know, some of that is some BABIP luck, but the reality is Cody Bellinger just doesn't hit the ball very hard anymore. And that is a big part of, as we're projecting him forward, yes, he's absolutely going to help the Yankees by playing multiple positions, and he will absolutely benefit from hitting in Yankee Stadium compared to hitting in Wrigley Field, where it seems like it was not a particularly hitter-friendly ballpark in 2024 in particular. But he is a good player and not a great player. And I think what's so interesting about this is when you realize the totality of the Yankees offseason and how much work they were going to have to do, even if they had brought Juan Soto back. Obviously, if they brought Juan Soto back, you're feeling better about everything because you still have the two of the best hitters on the planet. But even if they did, we'd still be looking at three positions and being like, what's the idea here? And the fact that Bellinger is the first one that seems to address one of these positions. Let's start talking about his fit now. We've established that we don't necessarily view him as a superstar caliber player. He is a good player that fits in a lot of ways. So what is the fit? We had some seemingly shaky reporting that he was told he was going to play center field. Aaron Boone refuted that already today, saying he's we don't know where he's going to play yet, which I think is true because, again, there's so much of this roster still to be filled out, but this is what Cody Bellinger does allow you to do is if you do want to play him in center field every day, is that the best idea? It certainly feels more reasonable because you just played Aaron Judge in center field every day. So in that sense, it's probably good.
How much gin do you play? You ever play gin?
Gin rummy? Or gin? Yeah, I do.
So Cody Bellinger is like picking up a card at the end of a set. Where you also have it potentially fits two sets. It could do a lot of things for your hand. You don't know where it's going to end up.
That's true.
Right?
But it's like, this helps me. This will help me.
Yeah. This gets me to where I need to go.
Yeah.
And that's Cody Bellinger. Because you might pick up a Pete Alonso from the deck. You might pick up a Christian Walker. You might not. Right. You know,
right. At which point maybe the other teams, you know, you lose and now you're like, okay, well, this didn't solve all my problems, but there was no single player that was going to solve all their problems. So we'll put the card game analogy aside and now look at this roster and depth chart and try to understand where he fits in, because center field and first base is where he has traditionally played. He was squeezed out of Chicago because of this, because Michael Bush ascended, because PCA ascended, because they traded for Kyle Tucker. There's no point in paying Cody Bellinger $25 million to be a league average bat in right field, not to mention Say Suzuki. But for the Yankees, I mean, the next move is very important because I think the center field thing did make sense to me just because there are more options for them to address first base than there are center field as things stand.
Yeah.
And because of that, I can't imagine a situation where Cody Bellinger plays more center field than he does first base in 2025 and potentially beyond. But maybe there is a center field option out there that we're not thinking of. And maybe Cody Bellinger ends up replacing Alex Verdugo in left. You know, there's possibilities there.
Mm-hmm. You're forgetting Dominguez, because Jason Dominguez looked so horrid in left that you could move him back to center. I know that sounds wonky, but he has a more experience playing center. He could play center field and then Bellinger could play left field.
Yes.
Considering that Yankee Stadium is such a cavernous left field, that might make some sense. We will go into camp, I believe, not knowing which of Bellinger and Dominguez is playing center or left. I do think when it's all said and done, you'll see some sort of rotation in the event that they add, say, Christian Walker, Stanton will get hurt, and that will, for a stretch, and that will open up DH opportunities as well. So trying to forecast this, like, a lot's going to change, right? But again, we keep going back to this. The point of Cody Bellinger is that he slots in at all these different places.
Yes. But I'm glad you mentioned Dominguez, because I wasn't necessarily forgetting about him, but he is one of the more fascinating players for the entire season, let alone the Yankees. Just because their confidence level in him, both defensively and offensively. And I don't know if Cashman or Boone had a quote today at the Max Fried presser where he was like, yeah, because obviously they're asking him about a million things beyond Max Fried. And he was like, yeah, like, I hope that this is Dominguez's time. But where that is defensively or offensively is very interesting. But your confidence that if it is that time, that maybe they're not adding another outfielder, which means we still have three unsettled infield positions, which is a really, again, first base. Jazz presumably will be playing third or second, but beyond that, you know, what is that? What is that next move? I think we'll probably find out at some point in the next little while. But Bellinger is certainly an interesting start there. Anything else on the Yankees part of this, or should we flip it to Chicago?
If their offseason ended today, which it does not, it is a bad offseason. It is an admirable pivot. To this point, I think getting Fried and Devin Williams, those are great. But they lost in the World Series because the rest of the non-Judge, Soto, Stanton hitters were bad. They have not solved that problem. They are back to where they were. Not even back to where they were. And so they need to add more impact up and down the order for me to feel comfortable and confident with them as favorites in the American League East entering the season. Just give me more juice. Give me more zip.
Yep. And I imagine they will continue to try and do that. Let's talk about the Cubs angle here before we take a break. I mean, again, it's very straightforward. This was a salary dump. They did not want to pay Cody Bellinger anymore, and they put themselves in a situation where they were not going to get much back. Cody Poteet, God bless him. He will help the Cubs. He'll throw probably 30 to 50 innings for them in 2025, as he did for the Yankees. Maybe not that many, but this is useful depth. He kind of backfills. They traded Hayden Wesneski. He kind of fills right into his spot on the depth chart. And like, that's a good guy to have around for any team. That's fine. But the reality of the trade is that they did not want to pay Cody Bellinger anymore, and now they won't be.
One of my favorite moments that I witnessed of the 2024 MLB season, which was a hydrogen bomb versus coughing baby meme, was Cody Poteet going toe-to-toe with Yoshinobu Yamamoto on a Friday night at Yankee Stadium against the Dodgers under the lights. First game of the three-game set. Juan Soto surprisingly suddenly not in the lineup with a weird elbow injury that we all thought was going to be a big deal. And Cody Poteet rolled out there and carved up the world champs for 4 2/3. It was awesome. It was amazing. The Yankees still lost because that's how things go. But in the World Series preview, the first game between the two teams in the World Series this year, in the regular season, Cody Poteet picked up that ball and he delivered. Best of luck to him in the Windy City. But yeah, like you said, I mean, this for the Cubs, it's a simple salary dump. The other way to think about this is it's a $5 million buyout for Cody Bellinger. I think it's more than the contract, though. He didn't fit the needs of the roster because the Cubs have a clear path forward at first base with Michael Busch and in center field with Pete Armstrong and in the corners with Kyle Tucker and Seiya Suzuki. Bellinger didn't fit that. He's not as compelling an option as those other players are right now. And so it made sense to trade him.
So I agree with that, but in the context of the Cubs, the team that hasn't won a playoff game since 2017, that the fans are tired of being mediocre, that wants this offseason to be a step forward. Yes, your team is better now because you have Kyle Tucker instead of Cody Bellinger. That's fine. But they're not saying, okay, awesome, you cleared this money. I'm so glad that, you know, the Ricketts don't have to pay Cody Bellinger anymore. It's now what? What are you going to do with that money? And if the Cubs are not going to blast into the luxury tax, as some of these other teams are, they now have more room under the first, you know, competitive balance tax line, which sits around whatever, $240 million. Now they're much farther away from that because they have gotten out from Cody Bellinger, that you would hope that there could be some more aggressive moves in this market. At the start of the offseason, you know, Jeff Passan came on here and said there's no indication that they're interested in spending at the top of the free agent market. That might still be true, but they certainly still have ways that they need to improve this roster, certainly in the bullpen. You could certainly still say in the starting rotation. And maybe there is a creative way for them to improve the position player group that we haven't quite, you know, wrapped our mind around yet. But that's what's so important here. We can't really, what it is right now is a salary dump, but there is a version or a sequence of this Cubs offseason that where they do end up looking like a much better team. And at this point, while we do commend them for being aggressive with Tucker, it's still going to take more than that.
They need to raise the floor here too. They need some veterans on the bench. They need Randall Grichuk or like trade for Eugenio Suarez. Like, they need a guy that's probably too expensive. They need a guy who's older with some rings around the tree.
Yeah.
To
lower, probably lower level bench. I'm trying to, scouring bench options is, again, I think Grichuk is probably too good, but I agree with you. The bench right now does not look like what you know, they need a little bit more help there. And then again, the bullpen is a huge question mark.
Just go pay Tanner Scott. Like, they should just give Tanner Scott whatever he wants.
Yes. No, I agree with that.
One last thing on Bellinger. Your sense, how much is he the caricature of himself? I think we're going to see even more of him. I know he's been on two high-profile teams already. The Yankees are a different beast. The wide-eyed, staring into the nothing, confused meme of Cody Bellinger. Is he that guy? My understanding is kind of like he's not that guy.
Yeah.
He's obviously more intelligent than every meme joke about him has ever led you to believe.
Yeah.
But there is a level of airheadedness, endearingly so, about Cody Bellinger that I believe does certainly exist.
Yeah. And I mean, he's pretty much acknowledged that because people have asked him about it like head on. And he's like, sorry, that's just my face. I don't think he's going to be hiding from it. I think he knows.
A former minor league teammate of his once told us something along the lines of, I'm glad that guy's good at baseball for his sake.
To be fair, not the only baseball player we've heard a similar sentiment about, but he's certainly the face of that.
Literally.
Of that archetype, if that is how we want to say it. All right, Cody Bellinger's on the Yankees. Again, we all kind of saw it coming. Let's take a quick break. And when we return, a bit of a different topic, as we're going to talk about elbows hurting a lot. Jake, you know a little bit something about that, right?
Oh, yeah. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. My elbow hurts all the time.
And you didn't even throw that hard. Jake Mintz, you have had Tommy John surgery. That is not the only reason we are about to talk about a very interesting report that Major League Baseball published. The full report, I have not seen the full 62 pages available anywhere, although I'm sure we could access it if we wanted to. But MLB, it's on MLB.com. The kind of biggest takeaways from this report, Jeff Passan wrote about it. He knows a little bit something about writing about pitching injuries, having written an entire book on the arm. That is what the book is called, The Arm. Jesse Rogers also had some kind of takeaways on ESPN about this. And I imagine you, as someone who has gone under the knife to repair your elbow for very different reasons than the reasons that the major leaguers worth, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars are doing it, I imagine that you also have some thoughts. So this could be its own podcast. This is such a massive topic that we have kind of touched here and there over our entire, you know, podcasting history, because it has always been relevant. It has only become more relevant since we started talking into microphones together 10 years ago. But this is kind of laying it all out there and kind of providing an opportunity, especially in the off season, for us to kind of sit back and be like, all right, what are the paths forward to start to try and understand this? Because none of this is going to be fixed with one rule change, with one anything, but at least it's all out there now. And now it's like, all right, what areas here can the league, can the sport, can the game, can the people who are involved start to try and address this issue?
A little bit of background. You mentioned my Tommy John surgery. For those who are maybe new, I played in college. I was really bad for 3 years. I was somehow excellent for the last year. I attempted to play professionally for a week in indie ball. It went poorly. I moved back to New York City, where I continued to throw in men's leagues a lot without doing any of the necessary arm care associated with throwing a lot. And so my elbow exploded. I then did not get surgery for a while because I just didn't need it and wanted to live my life and wasn't going to play anymore. But over time, it was hard to do a push-up and it hurt to do various tasks. And so in late February of 2020, good time to do this, I got Tommy John surgery and then did the rehab during COVID. And now I am a healthy, regular person whose elbow still creaks and cracks all the time, but it doesn't matter because I don't play. So that's just the background on me. I think the most important part about this report is that it is MLB, big ball, the power that be, saying stuff on the record. Now, MLB does not control the sport. The sport does not belong to the league, but the league is a powerful, the most powerful voice in the game. And so for the league to issue anything that says, here are some of the reasons that we think through our research are leading to an increase in arm injuries, that's important. A couple things I want to harp on, and I'm glad that the report mentioned these following things. These are my like three main takeaways. One, the trend of elbow injuries is not new to this past season. We had a number of very high-profile pitchers get hurt. Shane Bieber, Spencer Strider, last year Shohei Ohtani, Yuri Perez, year before that Shane McClanahan. And so that grabbed headlines and made us all very concerned. But this is something that has been going on for 5 to 10 years. This is, we did not see a spike in 2024. It was just the big names at the front of it. And the report kind of mentions that, kind of harps on that a bit. And I appreciated that. Number two, velocity matters. Everyone is chasing it. And no one should be blamed for chasing it. Players, pitchers are incentivized to throw the ball as hard as possible because it is a math problem. The harder you throw the pill, the less time the hitter has to react to the baseball and to make a decision about whether to swing or not or where to swing. Throwing harder is better. Generally, I don't need to explain that to you intelligent listeners. But because throwing harder is better, and we now have the technology, the training development resources to make people throw harder, folks are going to pursue that path. That path makes the elbow more susceptible to injury. That is the overwhelming number one reason that people around the sport believe. The numbers back this up. The average fastball velocity in MLB since 2008 has risen by more than 3 miles an hour, which is nut.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is not a coincidence. Getting pitchers to not throw that hard is a different conversation, but MLB going out there and saying velocity matters to injuries, that's important to have that on the record. Yes. It is not going to solve anything, but it is important. And then my last takeaway, the thing that surprised me the most, or the thing I learned from this, is the idea of when pitchers are throwing their hardest. When I was a bad college pitcher, I threw my hardest on the mound during games and in the bullpen working into games. During bullpens in between outings, I was probably like 95-90%. Nowadays, with the resources available for pitchers, high-speed cameras, motion capture, biometrical gobbledygook, they are throwing harder with high effort more often. So because they can track all that information and make adjustments to it to make them a better pitcher, when they pick up a baseball in spring training for a bullpen, they're performing. They're competing. They're not getting to where they need to be necessarily, even if that's what the team is telling them to do. All that information, all that data from every pitch they throw, that's funneling back to the organization that is making decisions on the player. And that is that everyone is working in their own self-interest there, and it all makes sense. But it is the dynamic at play brought about by new technology, and that development stretches into the offseason. Where in the old days, back when I was a youngin, players, their offseasons, they would just, you know, slam beers and sit on the beach They were off the offseason. Now, guys take a couple weeks, and then they're grinding until spring training. And for pitchers, a lot of times that means messing with new pitches, altering their mechanics, improving themselves for the upcoming season, which is a noble pursuit, but you are making your arm do more and more often. And that seems to be playing a significant factor. Now, I know I just spoke for a very long time. This is something I think about a lot. those were my three biggest takeaways from this report. Jordan, what tickled you?
You hit on a lot of the biggest parts. I think jumping off of the dynamic that you described, when we talk about velocity in baseball and we talk about, oh, all the pitchers, they want to throw hard. They're all throwing max effort more than they used to. That is all true. But it's not just that they are doing that in, you know, June in a regular season game, and that the starters are like, okay, I'm just going to go rip it for five innings and then, you know, hit the showers because my bullpen is awesome. That is a thing that is happening, and you can talk about that. But it, based on the other part about this, which is, you sort of touched on this, but the charts that show when these injuries are happening and when the IL placements are happening, which is overwhelmingly, especially over the last 5 years or so, in March and April, more than the rest of the season. It's interesting. It shows that pitching injuries during the season, IL placements during the season, have actually not gone up over the last 3-4 years. In fact, they've slightly gone down or about to stay the same. But when we're talking about March and April, that tells me, just what I'm gathering from this, is that is a response to the workload and the ramp-up process being so expedited and so incredibly intense for pitchers, for reasons that make sense, as we said. That's how you keep up. That's how you get better. That's how you get scouted. That's how you get added to the 40-man roster. That's how you, all these things, right, at every level of baseball. And that's going to get to my next point here, right? That's what's going to get you noticed. And so as long as you have the ability to train that, pitchers are always going to be incentivized to do that. But I think that, to your point, the part of the calendar and how much pitchers are now choosing to spend time on these things and ask their UCL to hold up over a lot more than just the 6-month season. And when these injuries are telling me, that is just, to me, has always been, as we've talked about this more and more over the past 5 years, the first thing that's always come to mind for me is that guys are just not taking time off. They're just throwing and throwing and throwing and throwing. Now, there is probably ways to do that. Some, I've, you know, read studies and heard smart people talk about this and talk about how there are benefits to continuing to throw throughout the winter and not just picking up a ball for the first time in February. And that might be true, but I have to imagine there's more of a balance than trying to rip, you know, the best spin rate and your highest velo on January 3rd, right? It's just, it's hard for me to imagine that that is the best way to train. But I want to get to the part about the other levels of baseball, because that is the other part about this that is so stunning, is they include a chart here, and I know you could talk about this at an even lower level, but there's a really incredible chart here about the number of players who threw 95 miles an hour at the Perfect Game National Showcase. So for those of you who don't know what this is, Perfect Game is, of course, basically the largest amateur baseball organization in the United States. It is, there are some problems with it, for sure. I don't need to go into the whole history, the pros and cons of Perfect Game, but the point is they're organizing the biggest showcases over the course of the summer at ages from way too young to up to where the guys are, you know, looking to get drafted when they're 15, 16, 17. So again, Perfect Game, larger conversation. But the point is the National Showcase is one of the largest showcases every summer of high school pitchers ages, again, 16 to 17. And that's, you know, over 100 pitchers or so are going and throwing at these showcases in front of dozens, if not hundreds, of scouts. And this chart shows that in 2024, there were 34 pitchers that hit 95 miles an hour at the showcase. That number was 3 in 2018. Not 1988, right? Not even 2008. This is less than 10 years ago. And so that just screams at me that these kids know how to train it. It's not like they're all suddenly that much bigger and stronger than they were in 2018, because that's not the case. But because of the technology and because of the training that has obviously completely taken over all levels of baseball, these kids know, oh, great, I want LSU to offer me. Well, I should probably throw 95. And they're learning that way, way, way younger than they, and can apply that way younger than they ever have. And now you have a situation where that timeline and that stress that you're putting on your arm through the increased velocity is now just coming at a much younger age.
But it's not the kids realizing this necessarily. It's the actors around youth baseball realizing mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
Now, I don't blame these people necessarily. If the kid wants to go to LSU and your job is to coach the travel team or be the high school coach or advise, your job is to get the kid what they want. And if the kid wants to pitch at a high level D1, they need to add velocity. And to do that, you got to shell out for training and weighted balls and, you know, good nutrition and all that stuff. And that, and this is where I can kind of hop in, that widens the economic gap in youth baseball. A gap that is already outrageous. It is the most expensive youth sport. It is a reason why lower income kids have flocked away from competitive baseball, because it's expensive. It's so expensive. Now, the kids that I coach are a little too young, 9, 10, 11, to really be adding velocity. Like, that's not something we coach or teach. At that age, it is move comfortably as a pitcher, throw hard, don't baby the baseball, but we don't use weighted balls. I did at the beginning when I started coaching just to work on like posture stuff. And it made me uncomfortable having a bunch of 9-year-olds pick up a driveline ball. So I just scrapped it. I think that the kids that can afford all that training are just going to be the ones that filter up into the higher levels of the game at younger ages. And that just accentuates the issue we already have in the game. Now, something this report does not do is offer solutions. There is no, here is how we fix this. And that's fine. Like, no one knows. We don't know. More research is a good thing. And thinking that any one prescription is going to remedy all of this is just misplaced. But now what? Okay, now what? They're going to do more research on spring training and off-season workloads. But I think in an ideal world, the way I would fix this at the major league level is you just limit roster sizes and you say every team has 8 pitchers and that's going to make teams want pitchers that work deeper into games. Now, the reason that is a bad thing and won't happen is because then you're reducing the number of big leaguers and the number of jobs and the union would never go for it. And I don't know if that's good for the sport, right? But I think that if you want to incentivize players to not throw as hard, you need to incentivize them to throw longer into games. I do think those two things are related.
Yeah, and this is absolutely part of the bigger conversation, right, about MLB wants to have starting pitching be prioritized again. How do you do that? And, you know, the commissioner has spoken about this. He was asked about this in an interview recently, and he basically said, like, it's going to take subtle roster changes or roster rules. The one you just described is a version of that. It's probably going to be a lot more low-key than that. But that's the way that you start to kind of integrate a version of something where teams actually have to change the way they're acting and thus change the way they're training, change the way they are prioritizing which pitchers that are going to end up on the roster. Because if pitchers realize my best chance of getting on the roster is actually if I can throw 5 innings and then not just throw a really good 3 innings or whatever, however you want to, you know, apply that logic, that would be over time could in theory change stuff about this. To me, yeah, the next steps are pretty overwhelming to try and know where to begin. But I have to imagine in the same way that however many years ago, you know, MLB came out with the pitch smart guidelines for youth baseball about how many pitches for each day. Like, I have to imagine they're at least going to be working towards something where it's like, this is what we recommend for off-season training, as you mentioned, for how often you should be throwing in the winter, for when you should be throwing a max effort bullpen in November versus February and stuff like that. And I also have to imagine that teams are already doing this research on their own. And there are absolutely clubs that have already had more success with this than others. And so this is already probably happening, right? There are absolutely clubs that probably tell their pitchers, you cannot throw a baseball between November 10th and November 30th. And because of players are in different situations, I'm sure different ones are more likely to listen to their club than others, but I'm sure that's already happening on a club club basis.
This is my last point. Follow the teams because they are the ones most incentivized from a competitive perspective to get to the bottom of this, even more than MLB. Now, MLB understands that not having Shohei Ohtani throw a baseball for a whole year is bad for business, yeah, but it's worse for the Dodgers. It's, you know, the Braves are hurt more by not having Spencer Strider than the league is. So The teams are going to be the ones at the forefront of this research. The Dodgers, who were decimated by pitcher injuries, launched an internal audit of their development systems already. And I think whichever club can begin to solve the pitching injury puzzle will have such a ridiculous competitive advantage in the beginning that these teams are charging for that. That is the next frontier. Now, it is a lot more difficult than the A's being the first team with an Excel spreadsheet in 2001 or whatever, right? But it, in my mind, like, good on MLB for releasing this report. I think the teams are going to be the ones who start to figure this out.
I like mostly agree with you. I think that the debate of whether who is more incentivized to figure this out is actually interesting, because you could argue that teams have realized this is a problem and they're just going to say, all right, you know what? Especially if you look at the Dodgers, it's like, listen, we'll just keep getting more that can give us as much as they can give us. And obviously some teams are in better position to do that than others. Whereas the league is looking at it from like an existential issue for the sport and for the game. And so not to mention having its biggest stars injured, it's also like a PR thing, right? I mean, that's also relevant. So, but to your point, I still agree that teams are certainly incentivized to figure this out because of the competitive advantages that in theory would be there if they were to quote unquote figure this out, which let's be real is probably not actually going to happen in some sort of full-fledged way, but maybe we will live to see something that something resembles some sort of solution here.
I like the idea that the Nationals director of biomechanics discovers that if you touch your toes at 9:35 a.m. on Tuesdays, then you can save your elbow.
We will we'll try anything to figure this out. All right, so yeah, you could go check out what Jeff Passan wrote, and MLB David Adler had a good piece on MLB.com with some of the takeaways. So encourage people to check that out and email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Let us know what you think.
In the meantime, I'm going to stretch my right arm. We will be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbecast. Now it's time to go around the league. We have two, I was going to say transactions, one non-transaction and one transaction that we want to hit on before we finish off with the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's begin with a trade that was reportedly set to happen until Nolan Arenado said no, no, no. We had some reporting over the last few weeks about Nolan Arenado and how the Cardinals intend to trade him, and he is ready and eager to be traded, but only if it is a team that he finds suitable. He has a no-trade clause in his contract, which means he can decide where he's going to go. And in this case, according to some reporting from Mark Feinstein and John Denton of MLB.com, as well as Katie Wu and Chandler Rome of The Athletic, the Astros were prepared to swing a deal for Arenado, and then Arenado chose to exercise that no trade clause and say no. However,
it's important to exercise. Exercise is good.
Exercise is important. Maybe that's the takeaway here. However, Chandler Rome also reports that this does not necessarily mean this deal is dead forever, but it is dead for right now, which is to say it is not dead. It is just not happening as we speak. And that is important. And I think an important detail when we talk about Arenado, and I think something for a lot of people to understand, is that, yes, there was some reporting on the list of teams that he wanted to be traded to. Apparently, again, this is also good reporting in The Athletic from Chandler and Katie talking about how John Mozeliak first approached Arenado in September about his intentions to trade him, and he said yes. Here are some teams. Apparently, the Astros were on that list at some point, but then perhaps that changed recently. The quote-unquote list does not exist. This is a matter of, it is a moving target. It is an evolving thing. And that is the power that Arenado has. That is what he has negotiated through his contract, is that he will collaborate with the front office on this deal. And if right now, in the middle of December, he does not feel like he wants to be traded to the Astros for whatever reason, he can say no. And that appears to be what happened. I don't know exactly what would need to change for him to change his mind and decide, yes, I do want to be an Astro. But that possibility remains on the table.
Here's how I see it. I'm on my honeymoon, right now. I'm staying in a nice hotel in Saigon, Vietnam at the moment. My wonderful wife is downstairs at the breakfast buffet. She probably walked into the breakfast buffet, walked past the egg station, and someone probably said, "Would you like any eggs?" And she said, "Not right now. Let me think about it. I'm going to see what else there is at this enormous breakfast buffet." She went and checked out the passion fruit and the toast and the croissants and the various offerings here at this
hotel.
Any
frosted flakes over there in Saigon? I don't know what her cereal preference is.
There probably not were corn flakes. There were corn flakes. Some breakfast pho, maybe.
Okay. Oh, delicious.
And then perhaps she will return to the scrambled eggs. And that is what Nolan Arenado is doing here. He is saying, he's not saying no to the Astros. He is saying, what else can you do for me? Is there anything else here? Any other interesting options? Because if he says yes to the Astros deal right now, then he's on the Astros. If he waits a month, there might be a better scenario for him. There might not be. Then he could always go back to the scrambled eggs.
Yeah. I think, I don't really have anything to add to that in terms of the Arenado side of it. I am intrigued about it as it relates to the Astros and Alex Bregman, because then you have people being like, oh, well, now they're still in on Alex Bregman. And to me, the fact that they had a trade lined up for Arenado that would have happened if Arenado said yes tells me they're probably not signing Alex Bregman. Like, Alex Bregman, at the time of this recording, is still unsigned, and maybe he finds his way back to Houston because Nolan never says this, and they remember how much they love each other, and Bregman takes some discount, whatever. That's fine. That's possible. I read that as, oh, they're ready to move on and Isak Paredes will play first base. That was what I am taking from this report.
You can't read this Arenado news and say, well, I feel better about Bregman going back.
Right. Like, the first thing is, oh, well, now they still need a third baseman, so they need Bregman. But, like, again, if we trust the reporting that they agreed to a deal to acquire Arenado, that... that would not suggest that there is still room for Mr. Bregman. So maybe I'm wrong there. I just, that tells me Bregman is headed elsewhere for a lot of money that is the Astros are not willing to pay.
Just because you went on a date with someone during your break, okay, doesn't mean you can't get back together, Jordan. That's all I'll say.
Oh, interesting lesson there. All right, moving on to another one of Jake's loved ones. The Baltimore Orioles, they made some news. They made a move. They acquired a pitcher. Very interesting pitcher. Tomoyuki Sugano, 35-year-old right-hander from Japan, who is one of the most accomplished pitchers in MPB history. Three-time MVP, MVP of the Central League in 2014, 2020, and 2024. He's obviously pitched for the Yomiuri Giants for a very, very long time. But that performance has certainly fluctuated. There, of course, we had him considering coming over to MLB a few years ago. He decided to re-up with Yomiuri. A couple seasons since then, he was not awesome. And then this year, it all came back together, having one of his best seasons, a 1.67 ERA in 156 innings, and only 111 strikeouts. And this is why this pitcher, who the Orioles signed for 1 year and $13 million, is a fascinating choice. Because
does he know they moved the fence in?
I was my first thought. I was like, ooh, I would like this a little bit more if some of those fly balls would just land softly in Tyler O'Neill's glove? Question mark? Or no, I guess he'll be in right. Colton Cowser, right? But he does an excellent job of mixing and matching and just throwing a ton of strikes. I mean, this guy throws six different pitches for strikes. He's, you know, the fastball's about 92 miles an hour, which does exist. You know, he's not throwing 89, but there's, you know, these kinds of pitchers in modern Major League Baseball occasionally, you know, give up some loud contact. And so this is quite the bet on his kind of veteran savvy, making the jump to MLB at a later stage of his career. And I'm really excited to see how this works out for them, because he's a big deal in Japan, and now he's a pretty big deal for the Orioles, although it's probably not their only pitching move this winter.
Most of the Japanese pitchers we've seen come over recently throw cheddar cheese.
Yeah.
This guy's throwing, you know, camembert. It's a little soggier. It's less firm. It's more give to it. And that's okay if he's going to rack up outs. Mm-hmm. An adorable thing about the signing that made me laugh is that because Sugano has played in NPB for such a long time, there's no posting fee. And it's just so Orioles. It's so Orioles. Not that they're being cheap. Like, they're spending $13 million on this guy. Like, it's a good thing. New ownership's investing. That's not what I'm saying.
Sure, I'm saying
every single time you see the Orioles connected to a free agent, it's like, oh, well, there's no qualifying offer attached. So they're interested. And so just to see that at the bottom of the article to be like, well, also, the Orioles didn't have to pay a posting fee. I was like, there's always a catch. That being said, I think Sugano is a fun fit. I think good comps for him, considering the low fastball velocity. You have Jameson Taillon on here. Seems like some similarities with Dean Kremer, a pitcher who the Orioles have helped. You know, not someone that you want starting a postseason game, but someone who is very valuable over the course of a regular season to suck up innings for you. I'm just fascinated to see what this is. And I am happy that Sugano ended up in a slightly abnormal place.
Hmm.
Because every time a Japanese player comes over and we're thinking about where they're going to go, it's like, well, there's got to be an enormous Japanese population. It's got to be on the West Coast, close to home. And that is not always true, right? Sometimes it's the team that offers the most money. Sometimes it's a team makes a good pitch about their competitive window. There's other factors involved. And so just like searching U.S. cities by Japanese population is just kind of a lazy way to think about it. And so I like when that narrative gets bucked, and this is one of those examples.
And seeing him, right, another recent Orioles in terms of just like this kind of starter was Kyle Gibson, which I know doesn't get people super excited, but like those pitchers can be very valuable, and there's kind of a mystery factor with Sugano, for better or for worse, that I think makes it more exciting. The one other thing I wanted to kind of jump off of with Sugano is just this market of the one-year starting pitcher in free agency. And it got me thinking about Max Scherzer, who I wrote a little bit about as one of the five free agents that I find really fascinating, who we've barely heard anything about. And he's in that bucket. And so far, you know, you look at who we've seen, what starting pitchers we've seen sign for 1 year. It's you know, the older guys. But we haven't seen that many of them yet. And the Orioles were a team that you would expect. I mean, again, Jeff Passan said that when we had him on. Like, that's the kind of player they're more likely to target rather than, you know, the long-term deal for a Max Fried or for a Snell or for a Corbin Burns. So far, you know, we'll move Nick Martinez qualifying offer to the side since that's a little bit different. We've seen Alex Cobb get $15 million, which was pretty stunning. But other than that, it's just been Sugano and Kyle Hendricks and I guess Bryce Wilson signed today, but that's a different category because he's younger and that's the White Sox. Like, I'm curious, who are the other older starting pitchers? Scherzer and Verlander are the obvious ones, right? I mean, Scherzer, I'm so fascinated about him because with both Scherzer and Verlander, it's like, do they just want to pitch no matter what? Or are they going to settle for less money to pitch for a team that where they can ring chase and you know, have that competitive opportunity? The Orioles would seemingly check those boxes. I don't know whether they're considering Verlander or Scherzer or, you know, Kershaw would be in this if we didn't already know that he was, you know, going back to the Dodgers. But Charlie Morton, right? I mean, I don't know what the status of him in Atlanta is, but he still wants to pitch and we've heard no progress there. You know, maybe there are some other ones like that. I don't know if Buehler is in that 1 year deal situation. I feel like he's probably going to end up getting multiple years, but that's just a subset of the free agency that I think we talk about every year. And there are some really interesting names in that, this, in that bucket this season. And Sugano was one of them. So I'm excited to see that he's one of the first ones to go.
It is time for everybody's favorite segment, the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good from the week, one thing bad, and one thing that reminds us of Dan Ugla. Odd, bizarre, wonky, weird. What's good for you this week, my friend?
I retweeted it. I'm actually going to pick two. I retweeted both of these things, both coming from the wonderful country, the Dominican Republic, which will also be featured in my bad momentarily. Ellie De La Cruz showed up to some field in his full All-Star Game uni and took some hacks, signed some autographs, took some pictures. And this is just such a wonderful flex, right? I mean, any big leaguer showing up, especially in DR Venezuela, to, you know, for whether it's a charity softball game or just showing up, just taking some swings with some kids watching, is always a delight to see. But to put the full uniform and the helmet, this isn't just the jersey. Sometimes you see guys go down there and just wear their big league jersey and, you know, just some shorts and some Jordans, right? And like no hat. This was the whole, I mean, we had the cleats, we had the helmet, we had the pants, we had the shin guard, everything. What he was wearing at his first All-Star game in Texas, he was wearing on this field in his hometown. And I just love it. And Ellie is delightful. And then the other one is John Kenzie Noel with some gigantic Christmas ornaments, which we literally joked about on our time capsule episode. He did it. He had this. He brought this to real life. And the Guardians Twitter account posting this photo that it just warms the heart.
So the funny thing about him in a full Santa costume, my first thought was, that's a big Santa costume. And then I was like, meh, they probably make Santa costumes in pretty big sizes.
Yeah. And Big Christmas absolutely fits it. That smile just, that'll get you through the Cleveland winter. That's for sure.
From Big Christmas to Little Hanukkah, congratulations to friend of the show, Garrett Stubbs, who was married over the weekend in Cabo. My invite is still in the mail, I'm sure. The reason I have this in good, besides liking Garrett, is that he did the Hora. Is that there is a photo.
Wow, I haven't seen this.
In People magazine of Garrett and his wife, Evan, lifted up in chairs doing the freaking Hora. And that combination, People magazine, baseball, backup catcher, and the Hora, is not a combo I ever thought I would say out loud on a podcast. So that is good. Congratulations to the Stubbs.
Other MLB adjacent guests in attendance who were either in his wedding party or not listed, who also hopefully participated in the Hora. So again, when you're watching these players, some of these players in 2025, just know that they participated in the Hora at some point over the winter.
The following list, the following players did the Hora.
Matt Chapman, Bradley Zimmer, who haven't heard that name in a while. Mickey Moniak, we love Mickey Moniak. Jeff Hoffman, free agent Jeff Hoffman. Tyler Wade, James Caprellian, Lars Nootbaar, and Nick Castellanos. What a squad. And maybe more than that. God, that fires me up. That is so good. So good.
The idea. Yeah. Sorry, dude. Nick Castellanos lifting someone in a chair for the Hora.
Wait, yeah. Who would you want lifting the chair of that group?
So I would guess that Kyle Schwarber was probably there. Or maybe he might have had a kid recently and so he wasn't there.
I feel like if he was there, we would know. Let's be real.
That is true.
Yeah.
But I know like Schwarber and Stubbs are very tight.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm sure he was invited. But
the answer is Schwarber. Like if you want maybe like any yeah. human being yeah. on earth lifting you yeah. up in a chair during the Hora.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's,
who's not Jewish?
One of your first picks. Yeah. My bad this week. We're going to go back to the Dominican Republic and talk about Albert Pujols.
Oh, no.
Uh-oh, Jake.
Uh-oh.
Albert Pujols is managing in DR for the first time, Leonis Del Escogido. And his team got off to a scorching start. 6-0. 14-4. They were running away with the Lidom regular season title. And then it has all gone horrifically wrong. Jake, they are now at risk of not even qualifying for the round robin. They have lost like 20 of their last 25 games. And Yadier Molina's Aguilas, who's hat I am wearing today, have just zoomed past him in the standings and are in great position to contend for the title. Now, there is like 4 or 5 games left in the regular season. They could still squeak in. And I believe Luis Rojas, the GM, has already said, like, Albert's going to stay the manager. We're not canning him. But there's, having talked to people down there, people want Albert gone.
And here's the thing. If Albert wasn't Albert, he'd be freaking cooked. The winter that I was down there.
10 days ago, he would have been done forever. I mean, my gosh.
The winter I was down there covering this league, 5 of the 6 teams in the league fired their manager at some point during the season. Okay. The only two that didn't fire the manager won.
And that is the beauty of the Dominican Winter League. Talk about, there ain't no rebuilding. If you ain't winning, we don't want you. So Albert, again, maybe there is a happy ending to this story. They still, you know, qualify, but it is not looking great. They got rained out tonight, so we'll see if they can hang on to that last postseason spot.
It does not seem like Albert Pujols will be the next manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. At least not yet. My bad is the rate. Guaranteed Rate Field is dead. Long live Guaranteed Rate Field. The Chicago White Sox home ballpark has a new name. No longer is it Guaranteed Rate Field. Now it is just Rate Field.
So it has been Guaranteed Rate Field since 2017, which honestly feels like way more time than in my head. But this is, I guess, the risk of any corporate partnership is that the company changed their name. This was not a White Sox decision. And right. So they had an agreement. And so they were just kind of beholden to now being Rate Field, which,
right, you know, like
to the list of White Sox things that we can laugh at. But this was not, it's not like they were like, that's what this is. Well,
if
here we go.
The company Oracle changes its name to I Hate Buster Posey, then the Giants have no
contract
but to be I Hate Buster Posey Park. You know, that's just the way business
like Yachty
works.
Was better field.
The best part about this is that Rate Field sounds like Right Field, and we don't really know who's going to be playing right field.
No, for the White Sox. I think it's Mike Tauchman. I think they signed him so that they could kind of answer that question when they knew they were about to change it to Rate Field. They are sort of going with my, you know, when we talked about the Daikin Park change, I was like, you know what? Fewer words is good. Like fewer syllables is generally good. However, Rate Field just like feels uncomfortable to say.
It's too quick.
It's too short. It's too short.
Who is the all-time leader in WAR amongst Rate Fielders for the Chicago White Sox? Let's see.
That's a great question. There's probably an obvious answer. Do you have that? Do you have that for us?
Maglio Ordóñez. Ordóñez is the best Rate Fielder of all time.
He did play in that ballpark, so right, because that ballpark opened. Yeah. 1991. All right. Congratulations to the White Sox. Staying in the news. My Ugla this week. We started with Cody Bellinger and we are going to end with Cody Bellinger because there's one thing we haven't talked about yet. His dad. Clay Bellinger played for the Yankees and you're going to hear all about it every single time Cody Bellinger steps up to the plate. But one thing about Clay Bellinger, who won the World Series with the Yankees in 1999 and 2000, I was intrigued by him because we'd say about Cody Bellinger, oh, what would you say before? Well, man, he can do all these things. So much versatility. A lot for a ball club. Okay, but first base and center field is nothing compared to what Clay Bellinger was doing. Because in the year 2000, Clay Bellinger appeared at all 7 positions at least 5 times. And he was the first player in Major League history to do so in 2000, alongside Denny Hocking. And so I just wanted to rattle off the list of players who have done this since then. Again, 5 games at all positions, not pitcher or catcher. Clay Bellinger and Denny Hocking were the first. Afterwards, Denny Hocking did it the next year. Chris Woodward, 2005, who's now back with the Dodgers. Brock Holt, 2014. Sean Rodriguez, 2016. Andrew Romine, 2017. Kike Hernandez, 2018. Danny Santana, batting cleanup for Estrellas right now, 2019. And there was a player who did it in 2024, and his name is Mauricio Dubon.
My guess would have been Willie Castro.
Yeah, well, I know. I've done an ugly like this on Willie Castro, but no, he did not get quite enough games at, I believe, first base. I don't think he played much first base. But anyway, Clay Bellinger, you did a lot of things for a ball club. Don't let people say that your son was a better utility man than you were.
The reason Clay Bellinger needed to do so many of those things for a ball club is that guy could not hit. Oh, my God.
Correct.
What a bad hitter.
Correct. All right, what's your ugly? Finish us off.
My ugly is the billion-dollar boy. I wrote about this week at Yahoo Sports. Juan Soto got $765 million, potentially $800 million. And that got me thinking, who's going to get to a Billy first? Now, in doing this, I first went back and looked at who the first million-dollar player was, which was Nolan Ryan, was the first player in 1979 to get $1 million a year. But Mike Schmidt, 2 years earlier, was the first player to sign a contract where the full value of it was over $1 million. That was 1979. Now we're at Nolan Ryan's contract was 4 years, $4 million. And people were like, whoa.
I know this isn't really remotely a fair comparison. However, I don't think it will take 40 plus years to get to $1 billion in the way that it did to get from $1 million to even 800. Million. I guess that's not really a fair comparison because we haven't gotten to $1 billion yet.
We hit,
but now we're talking about it.
We are talking about it. And this is a dumb thought experiment that has no real value. I went around the winter meetings asking baseball people about it. To a person, they agreed that the billion-dollar boy was alive and kicking on the planet right now, and that we don't know this person's name yet. They're probably like 9 years old in either the Dominican Republic or Japan, and that they will debut in the big leagues in the next 10 to 15 years, right?
Yeah, you hit on a bunch of candidates and we don't have to go through them. I encourage people to go and check out the ones you wrote about. And I think of the active players, you know, Gunnar and Ellie are the ones where, yeah, if they both put up 9 WAR for each of the next 5 seasons, sure. It's a hard thing to do. But the key, the number one most important thing is to get to the big leagues as fast as possible. That is really what it is, because so much of Soto's value is that he is so young, on top of the fact that he's one of the greatest hitters we've ever seen. But the thing that I keep coming back to is, while the inclination is to go find the phenom, right? Soto wasn't that. We didn't know that he was that until he was doing it in the major leagues. And so that's the thing that when we think about this, if it is just going to be another Soto type, which is just adjust for inflation and have another generational hitter who gets to the big leagues and is immediately one of the best hitters ever at age 20 or 19.
That's it. That's all you got to do.
That's all you got to do. It's not an easy thing, but I don't know. Maybe that is someone that isn't the number one prospect in baseball. But I do agree that that person is already alive. So we'll see it. I don't know if we'll still be podcasting, but it'd be fun if we were.
I think in diving into this, my big takeaway was not just age, is what type of player. Like, you want it, you look at Ellie De La Cruz and you're like, what a valuable player. But Ellie's value comes from all these different things, which in a backwards way is not what you want, because it's harder to project that down the road. Whereas for Juan Soto, he is an offensive tornado. And because of that, he's automatic. It's automatic. That's the type of guy you want to give the money to, who's going to decline at presumably a slower rate. Presumably. Who the hell knows, right? I threw out both of the Holiday brothers, Ethan Holiday, Jackson Holiday. I think Leo DeVries, who is a Padres minor league shortstop, was a fun one just because he went from being signed to low A in a year. And
again, you got to find the guy that's going to be really good and be in the big, because but when we're already talking about all star players that are reaching free agency at 29 and 30, it's just not going to be possible. But if you can be talking about a 14, 15 year deal, now we're at, with inflation and the AAV bumps, like now we're getting into the range.
The one that I should have put on there was Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah, probably. Why. Oh, if Andrew Friedman decides to stop being in charge anymore.
If the professional
and he hires Scott Boras.
Bingo. If the president of baseball operations, Andrew Friedman, leaves the Dodgers, Shohei Ohtani is allowed to say, "See you later, buddy." And so if that happens, if Andrew Friedman like watches Welcome to Wrexham and gets super into kicking that footy around and he bounces and Shohei becomes a free agent and hires Scott Boras, well, guess what? Now we know how valuable Shohei Ohtani is to a baseball club.
And this is after he comes back and pitches and, you know, wins the Cy Young. So, right, because I've honestly had the thought of like, how much more would he have gotten if he never got injured pitching? You know,
like, seems like a lot now.
Probably
I
more.
Think I come back to the biggest reason Ohtani's price didn't get where Soto's did is that he didn't want to play for the Yankees or the Mets.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was like, all right, we got a 700. Let's wrap it up. I'll be a Dodger now. That's fine. Bless him. God, it's so funny. Anyway, go check out Jake's story. Some other fun names in there that I won't spoil.
Baseball in the Wild. Very quickly. I saw my first Scherzy last night here in Saigon.
Ooh.
Any guesses?
Aaron Judge.
Give me one more guess.
Active. Oh, Ohtani.
Yes. Yes. Shohei Ohtani. Angels.
Angels. Nice.
City nice. Connect Scherzy.
That's a great pick, actually.
Deep cut.
I kind of love that. That's good. I'm glad that his Angels legacy is sustaining in Saigon.
Two Oakland Athletics shirts as well, for some reason.
Oh. You're going to have to break the news to them on the other side of the world. Sacramento now, baby, but you got Luis Severino. That's going to do it for this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you, Andrew Hartz, for producing. Thank you, Cody Bellinger, for giving us so much to talk about, and you, the listener, for enjoying our podcast. We appreciate it. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Keep those emails coming, and we'll be back next week. Jake Mintz, final word.
Thank you to the capitalist Wi-Fi at this Marriott property.